From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the global spotlight fixes on Sochi this weekend, the Russian government is crushing dissent. And there's a lot of it. As the Committee to Protect Journalists notes in a new report, people there have suffered long-lasting power outages, contaminated water or no water at all, and eviction if their home stood in the way of Olympic construction. They've been victim to widespread violations of labor laws and witness to corruption in the form of illegal building permits for the wealthy, unrelated to the Games. To quash the complaints, the authorities have denied several political activists the spectator passes they need to enter sporting venues, where they might meet foreign reporters. And they've jailed environmental activists, one on the pretext of swearing in public. The local media, meanwhile, have been conscripted to do public relations for the government, says Nina Ogyanova of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
National television stations and news agencies receive their directives from the central authorities as well as from the municipal authorities. And the directive is to cover the Sochi Olympics the way that media would cover a deceased person, either in positive light or not at all.
Give me examples of how stories were spiked or changed in order to reflect this directive.
In one incident, a journalist working for a major news agency in Sochi told us that her editors in Moscow completely rejected three stories that she pitched to them. The first story had to do with a local journalist who was incarcerated on false charges by the local police. The second story had to do with faulty waterworks at a hastily built building where Sochi residents evicted from their homes were being resettled. The third story had to do with just worsening of the local weather in Sochi. At one point, the editor told this correspondent, you may have a storm, you may have a twister, or even a 9 Richter scale earthquake. We still have to write that all skies are clear over Sochi.
So there is clearly an information vacuum in Sochi. Your report says that activists have made an effort to fill in for the journalists. How's that working?
The activists started covering these issues through their personal blogs, through posting a video, through social media, and they have incurred the wrath of the local government.
Like what?
For example, one particular activist, Soren Gazarian, had to flee the country because of trumped up charges of murder.
How do you know it's trumped up?
Gazarian, along with some of his colleagues from Ekovakta, which is a very prominent environmental organization in the region, went to assess the possible environmental effect that the building of a private marina, allegedly for Vladimir Putin, had on the local environment. When they went to visit the site, they were accosted by private guards. One of the guards twisted Soren Gazarian's arms. When he tried to rid himself of the grip, he picked up a small rock and told the guards to back off. This incident was used as pretext for one of the guards to file criminal charges.
Attempted murder.
Attempted murder.
By
that's
small
correct.
Rock.
Yes.
With the same group, Vladimir Kimeyev had started blogging about a lot of environmental damage connected with Olympic preparations, including water pollution, deforestation, mudslides, and so on. When people had problems, they started calling him, not local law enforcement, not local media. They didn't see anybody else taking an interest.
That's right. The state media have not only ignored the subject of environmental damage and other rights violations, but have outright vilified the victims. The state-owned NTV, which is one of the biggest television stations in Russia, in fact did a so-called documentary in which it portrayed victims of eviction pegged to the Olympic Games as greedy residents who wanted to enrich themselves on government dime.
Speaking of self-enrichment, your report begins with
the story of Roman Kuznetsov, who is a construction worker sent down to Sochi to help build for the Olympic Games. And like many, many, many people not paid, there's not been a single case filed against any of the employers that have denied these men their wages. He sewed up his lips using a needle and black thread and held up a paper saying, "Please help get the reporter's attention. I'm not from around here." Did he get the reporter's attention?
He did, but he got the international media's attention. The activist we spoke to said that first they go to the international media, and only after the story gets so big that it transcends the boundaries of Russia that some media locally start picking it up. In most recent months and even days, the authorities have started rounding up and even preventatively detaining activists.
So if Putin sweeps them from the streets of Sochi, there'll be no one for the international media to talk to.
The administration has gone beyond any previous recorded attempts to clear the space of inconvenient voices.
Did you happen to see Pussy Riot on the Colbert Report?
No.
Oh, they were remarkable. Do you see a possible opportunity in activists from Russia telling their stories on American soil?
It's a very difficult question because the bravest and the most critical voices of Russia, they have to be able to do their job in Russia. And a big responsibility falls upon the International Olympic Committee. The IOC has to urge the Russian government to keep to their commitments as enshrined in the Olympic Charter. Those commitments include guaranteeing press freedom at least for the duration of the Games.
Nina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nina Ogyanova is the Europe and Central Asia Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
You seem like a nice couple of kids. What I don't understand is why you would be going against someone like Vladimir Putin, who is just trying to preserve the peace and bring Russia into a brighter future. What do you have against Vladimir Putin? He's a strong man. That's what Russia needs.
У нас разные представления о светлом будущем. Мы не хотим, чтобы светлое будущее России вел чувак с голым торсом и на коне.
We have different ideas about a bright future, and we don't want a shirtless man on a horse leading us into that.
NBC spent $775 million for the rights to the Games and will provide more than 1,500 hours of coverage, most of it on the events themselves. But it also sent reporters to cover Russia's many political subplots. The country was a controversial choice for the Olympics because, well, pick a reason. A retrograde anti-gay law, President Vladimir Putin's growing authoritarian grip, and recent terrorist attacks with the explicit threat of more. NBC's chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel is among the reporters deployed to cover the political backdrop to the Olympics.
There's the security concern. There are human rights concerns. There is the question of why is it being held in Sochi at all? It's on the Black Sea. For the Games, they had to build an entire city in the mountains outside of Sochi. So there's going to be a tremendous amount.
Bob Costas on the sports side has said that if an act of terrorism were to occur or some sort of political unrest during the Games, we won't be seeing his face. We'll be seeing the NBC news team, including you.
He's correct. And that was the same situation when I was in China, for example. We wouldn't have our boxing analyst in Beijing commenting on a breaking news situation.
Is the network prepared to put your face in the midst of the 1,500 hours of sports coverage that it's bought and paid for from the International Olympic Committee?
If it's a major news event, yeah, of course we're going to go into news coverage mode. I would be shocked if it happened any other way.
I don't ask these questions for no reason. I alluded to the $775 million that NBC has paid the IOC for rights, and the IOC wishes that it were just all speed skating and ski jumping and ice dancing all the time. But it has always been impossible to separate politics from the Games. It's always, at a minimum, the backdrop, no?
Every Olympics has a political dimension to it. It's going to be an opportunity for us to put some Russia stories on, exploring not just the games, but all of the regional impact. But I wouldn't expect NBC Sports or the IOC to necessarily see that as a priority.
It is now a crime in Russia to almost discuss the issue of gay rights because it's deemed propaganda, which is now against the law. Should there be, for example, protests? Should an athlete make some sort of pro-gay rights gesture, a rainbow flag or some such? How can you cover that without explicitly breaking the law of the host country?
We may have a legal issue on our hands. The same way when I'm in Egypt and there's people protesting and the police come and start breaking heads, it's also illegal to report that. Almost every country where I report has laws that say you can't do things that harm national security. You can't film activity that will disrupt the moral order of society. Unfortunately for the host government, that is part and parcel of what we do. And frankly, with the technology that is available to everyone, if someone rolls a rainbow flag at an event, people are going to post it online. And I'm not sure how Russia would be able to contain something like that. And if there is a violent incident, we're also going to have to distinguish the normal ongoing conflict that they've had in Russia going back to the collapse of the Soviet Union from a distinct terrorist attack targeting the Olympics that puts athletes or anybody like that at risk.
So you have to take care not to overplay one of those episodes, which are sadly commonplace, just because you happen to be in Russia covering the games.
Exactly. I've already been here for a couple of weeks to meet with the security officials, to meet with some of the locals, to meet with academics, to get a sense of the rhythm of violence. What is the normal baseline here?
Whether we're talking about China or even the 1936 Berlin Games, Hitler's big platform for his Nazi state, inevitably, when the press covers the sporting event, it is being an enabler of propaganda. And I wonder to what extent the sports division, for its part, and then NBC News, has to take care not to enable Putin's big show for the world.
First of all, I think it's probably more akin to China than certainly Nazi Germany. I mean, I think Putin has his faults, but this isn't Hitler. But I see what you're saying. We are focusing on Russia. If the Russians win events, then the Russians will be getting good publicity. I'm going to be here talking about the rest of the country, the good, the bad, and the ugly. If anything, it's an opportunity for our viewers to learn something about Russia, to spend 2 months. That's a great opportunity. I'm going to do more stories on Russia than I've done in years.
All right, Richard. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Richard Engel is NBC's chief foreign correspondent.
Coming up, more sports news that has absolutely nothing to do with sports.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Super Bowl Sunday, right before kickoff, Fox News' Bill O'Reilly sat down with President Obama for a one-on-one interview. As expected, O'Reilly covered the issues that have been at the core of his cable channel's unrelenting critique of the Obama presidency: the rocky Obamacare rollout, the attack in Benghazi, and the alleged targeting of conservative groups by the IRS. In general, the question centered on the scandals that, after repeated official inquiry by Congress and inspectors general, turned out to be mere screw-ups with no evidence of White House fingerprints or cover-up. The president had little difficulty deflecting the implicit accusations. The question is, in this rare opportunity for a live one-on-one, what did O'Reilly accomplish? Connor Friedersdorf, a staff writer for The Atlantic, thinks the answer is not much at all.
Well, I'm someone who writes a lot about the NSA and the United States having a lethal targeting program abroad. I would have loved to hear the president held to account on those issues in the way that he hasn't been. You know, we all have our hobby horses, but I would say that Bill O'Reilly didn't really advance public knowledge on any issue, whether it's my issue or your issue or someone out there in the audience. We don't know anything more than we did before the interview. For me, one telling moment was when Bill O'Reilly brought up the issue of healthcare.gov. and the healthcare reform bill. And that framing is very telling. Bill O'Reilly was trying to embarrass Obama rather than eliciting information from him. And he could have asked a question that actually reflected badly on President Obama and elicited information. He could have pointed out that President Obama hasn't done anything of substance to make sure that the federal government can have a good rollout of a website in the future. President Obama has basically said that we have this broken system and you can't blame it entirely on us, and that's a fair point. What has he done to make the next federal website launch successful?
Here's tape which gets to the question of whether a politically motivated or incentivized IRS was targeting conservative groups with undue attention.
What some people are saying is that the IRS was used at a local level in Cincinnati, maybe other places, to
absolutely
go after.
Absolutely wrong.
But
absolutely.
How do you know that? Because we still don't know what happened there.
Bill, we do. That's not what happened. Folks have, again, had multiple hearings on this. I mean, these kinds of things keep on surfacing, in part because you and your TV station will promote them.
But when don't folks you feel actually, there are unanswered questions?
Bill, when you actually look at the stuff, there have been multiple hearings on it.
The frustrating thing there is that if Bill O'Reilly had an inkling of evidence tying President Obama to a campaign to use the IRS politically, we would hear about it every day on Fox News. It's unthinkable that President Obama, in the face of no evidence, would come on and say, well, actually, Bill, there is a secret conspiracy that I've been involved in. It's just in no world would that possibly elicit a useful answer.
I want to take some issue with your thinking on this, because while everything you say would make sense if we were talking about a prosecution, journalism isn't necessarily meant to be a gotcha enterprise. Sometimes it's just important to hear the public officials' response on a controversial issue.
Absolutely. The problem is that all of these things where Bill O'Reilly says, I just want to get you on the record here, Mr. President, we've had countless press conferences in which a White House official or President Obama specifically has been asked about the IRS scandal. We've had congressional hearings. The work of getting President Obama on the record about these issues happened long ago.
You write that while the interview was unsatisfying and unproductive, that it probably served the purposes of both the president and Bill O'Reilly. What do you mean?
For Bill O'Reilly, the Fox audience wants someone to stand up and to flay Obama and to kind of suggest that he's illegitimate somehow and that there is a looming scandal, and he accomplished that. President Obama, on the other hand, was able to take what were really very weak critiques of his presidency and to hit the softballs out of the park, basically. He was also able to appear as if he's willing to go before a tough interviewer. In fact, there are plenty of interviewers that President Obama could have gone against that would be much tougher. But instead, he chose Bill O'Reilly, and they both got something out of it.
Hmm. Well, if there's one exchange that supports your notion of the shtickization of the presidential interview, it was in the second part of the interview that aired Monday night on O'Reilly's program. Here's what it sounded like.
I can't speak for Fox News, all right? But I'm you know, the table setter here at 8 o'clock. Yeah. You think I'm unfair to you? Do you think I can give you?
Absolutely. Of course you are, Bill. But I like you anyway, though.
Okay, but give me how I'm unfair. Give me how I'm unfair. Come on. You can make that accusation without telling me.
Bill, we just went through an interview in which you asked about healthcare not working, IRS, were we wholly corrupt, Benghazi,
right?
So the list of issues that you talk about.
But these are unanswered questions.
But they're defined by you guys in a certain way. But look, this is okay. If you want to be president of the United States, then you know that you're going to be subject to criticism.
Amazing. It had a kind of enough about me, what do you think of me quality to it. How do you spend your precious moments with the president of the United States talking about what he really thinks of me?
Yes. It is nice to hear President Obama be frank in that way in the interview, to acknowledge that there is this dynamic between his presidency and Fox News, and to just kind of lay it on the table. At the same time, President Obama is playing a role in elevating Fox and Bill O'Reilly by granting them this interview. There are any number of journalists generally, if he wanted to subject himself to an interview by someone who's been critical of him. And he chose Bill O'Reilly to the extent there's a problem. He is a little bit of a part of it. I compared it to a WWE match where you have two people that appear to be hitting each other over the heads with folding chairs, but in fact, they're entertaining the audience. And that's what this was.
That's a pretty good one, too. Connor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Connor Friedersdorf, who spoke to us from Los Angeles,
writes for The Atlantic.
Just the great and powerful who use the occasion of the Super Bowl to snag the ears of the multitude. It's also the small and the addled, like the guy who seized the mic during a post-game press conference to spout the so-called truther theory that we bombed ourselves on 9/11.
I always imagine myself making great plays, but you never think about being MVP.
To investigate 9/11, 9/11 was perpetrated by people within our own government.
His name was Matthew Mills, and in certain precincts of the media, he was a moth to flame that burned brightly for a moment and then, poof, was gone. But there were collateral effects. Another Matthew Mills, by dint of his name, came in for some residual heat as sports radio came calling. He didn't say he was the other Matthew Mills. He didn't say he wasn't either. On the media's PJ Vote, got Matt on the phone. First, you'll hear tape of Matt's moment on WCCO Minneapolis, then Matt talking to PJ, then PJ.
Good morning. I am great. It's a wonderful day to be a Patriot.
Yes.
And the guy's really super nice. Like that good old Midwestern charm.
So did you feel a little guilty?
I started to feel a little bit like, all right, I gotta kind of come out of this. So they gave me an opportunity. They went to an audio clip again from the 9/11 truther, from the other Matthew Mills. And they came back and they asked something like, I can't believe we've got you on the phone. How would you ever get out of, you know, jail or whatever? And I was like, guys, it's not me. And the guy was like, oh, you punked us.
You guys are awesome. You got the wrong Matthew Mills.
We got punked then.
A little bit.
He wasn't too mad.
He wasn't mad at all. Kyle, the producer who was also on the air, was not happy.
Kyle's not happy.
Yeah, he can go screw himself.
So then about an hour later, I get a call from WMGC 105.1 in Detroit, the ESPN affiliate, sports radio. And the guy was just really aggressive. I didn't like him at all.
What do you mean when you say really aggressive?
Hey, Matthew, what's up, man? Listen, hey, man. Love what you're doing. Want to put you on the air. And he's like, we're going to call you back in like 15 minutes, and we'll do a pre-tape for our afternoon drive. And I was like, all right, great. Now I'm thinking in the next 15 minutes, this guy is going to figure it out, and I'm not going to get a call back, right?
Right.
He's going to do a little more research. Says, let me just double-check this guy. No such thing. So they call.
Oh. Hey, Matthew.
Yes. I just kept rolling with it, and we were on for like probably 9 or 10 minutes.
Detroit, how you doing?
Fine. How are you guys?
Okay. So you played basically the character of
9/11 truth or crazy guy
for 10 minutes.
Yeah. And they were just like asking the most inane questions, and I was giving more inane answers.
And you got your message out, which is that you think there's a conspiracy involving 9/11 specifically, right?
Don't you? They asked, you know, something about a conspiracy theory and how do people control their minds? And I was like, Scientology. And then they're like, well, how do you protect yourself from being overwhelmed by all this mind control? And I was like, a helmet.
So what sent your truth or what's the truth?
I think you just need the truth is you need to investigate. You journalists need to do your job better.
We're asking the person who was there.
I wasn't there on 9/11.
No, not regarding 9/11, regarding yesterday.
Yeah, what about yesterday? It was great.
I don't feel too bad for these guys because I don't think what they were trying to do was even that good. And I think that a journalist should be careful. But I also feel a little bit bad because I've had the job of having to quickly find someone, and if someone wanted to trick me, like if someone wanted me to believe that they weren't who they said they were, I don't know how I'd fact check that.
You might say, is this Matthew Mills? Yes, it is. Are you the same Matthew Mills that busted into the Super Bowl last night and interrupted the MVP press conference? No, I'm not.
They didn't do that?
They did not do that.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah, no, I don't feel bad for them.
Not at all. And never mind, like, just the grossness of trying to get that person on the air who, you know, he's not necessarily playing on the same level field that we all think we are.
If you're booking him, you want to hear from him because he's made a spectacle out of himself and because you want to continue that spectacle, not because you want to air his views.
Right.
And do you feel like you've learned something or like that your perspective has changed this week, or did you have sort of a low opinion that's just been confirmed?
I have had a pretty low opinion that's been confirmed, but I also probably think I found a softer spot in my heart for people with really extreme opinions, No wonder they want to try to jump into a press conference or streak across a stage or, you know, whatever. The attention you get right after is apparently huge. I mean, I can't imagine what the real guy's email and Facebook and Twitter feeds are like. I'm like the loose change.
That was filmmaker Matthew Mills speaking to OTM's PJ Vogt. You want to hear the longer version? Subscribe to TLDR on iTunes and go to tldr.onthemedia.org for daily posts.
And yet another Super Bowl sidebar. This one involves a PSA produced by the National Congress of American Indians. It argued that the name of the Washington NFL team, the Redskins, is a word Native Americans would never use.
Unyielding, strong, indomitable. Native Americans call themselves many things. The one thing they don't.
That thing is a picture of the Redskins' helmet. A few media outlets have already decided to drop the term, reasoning that it is at best offensive to Native Americans, and at worst a slur not much different from the N-word. OTM producer Chris Neary has the story of one of those publications.
The debate over whether the Washington Redskins should retain that name got supercharged last October when President Obama made a tepid statement about it.
I've got to say, if I were the owner of the team, and I knew that there was a name of my team, even if you know, it had a storied history that was offending a sizable group of people, I'd think about changing it.
A few high-profile journalists have staked out stronger positions through the years. Bob Costas, ESPN Stephen A. Smith, and editor Jillian McGoldrick.
I used to do a bunch of like the CYO stuff. I do like my church youth group. I work at a bakery. And I sell water ice, too.
And tell me how old you are and what high school you go to.
I am 17. I go to Neshaminy High School.
McGoldrick is the editor-in-chief of the Neshaminy High School Play Wikian. That's Lenape Indian for Meeting Place of Turkeys. In October, the paper's editors took a vote and ran an editorial titled, Why We Won't Publish the R-Word. They decided the R-word was racist and, quote, very much so.
Kids were threatening to rip it up, use it for kindling. They said they were going to light it on fire. They were not going to read it. They refused to read it. They refused to touch it. We were enemy number one in our school for a little bit.
Neshaminy is a sports powerhouse. Its football teams are among the best in suburban Philadelphia.
Here come the Redskins!
The editorial hit a nerve. But soon, students got back to reading the paper. It's high school. Drama comes and goes. The story would have ended there, but...
Neshaminy School District administrators have told the high school's student newspaper editorial staff to hold off on its new policy not to use the sports team's Redskins nickname. Administrators.
The school's principal, Dr. Robert McGee, emailed the paper's advisor with the directive to hold the new policy until he could meet with the paper's editors. McGee declined to comment for this story, but according to reports, he had two objections. First, he didn't think the name was, in fact, racist. Second, and more importantly, he questioned whether the editors had the right to exclude the word. Wouldn't the policy infringe on other students' First Amendment rights by preventing them from using the word when writing for the paper? The story went national. Here's a clip from the Keith Olbermann show about McGee and the then school board president.
He and the principal telling them they must use it in America. Principal Rob McGee and school board president Richie Webb of Neshaminy High School in Pennsylvania, today's worst persons in the sports world.
I should note here that McGee has called what the students did valiant, and he nominated McGoldrick for a leadership award. This isn't the Pentagon Papers. McGee has asked the students to prove that they have the right to exclude the R-word from the paper.
My name is Gail Sproul, and I'm a partner in the law firm of Levine, Sullivan, Koch & Schultz. In Philadelphia, we do only media work, primarily media defense work.
Have you defended a high school before?
I never have been involved with a high school student before other than my own children.
What began as a decision by 21 teenagers has led to both the paper and the district taking on lawyers. On the editor's side, Sproul says that the Supreme Court and Pennsylvania state law give the students the right to change their policy. Also,
the First Amendment prevents school administrators from compelling students to speak, to say things that they do not wish to say. And, you know, in our view, this is a case where the students do not want to use a word, and the administration would be compelling them to do so. And that's a violation. And in fact, the thing that they don't want to say, they have found to be a hateful term.
Mike Levin, the lawyer who represents the district, says the law allows the school to override the editors. And anyway,
the word Redskin is not thought of and has not been used in the Neshaminy School District as a term that means anything other than a term of distinction, a term of honor, a term of respect. So why are we arguing about the fact that some people might find it offensive because some people a long time ago may have used it in an offensive way?
There may not be a single student at Neshaminy High School who means to offend when they use the term Redskins, and there probably aren't many Washington Redskins fans who do either. Nevertheless, right now, you won't find the word Redskin in the pages of the Playwickian. The students are on top while the lawyers are working it out. But here's something permanent. After reporting on the student's decision, a local paper in Neshaminy stopped using the word. Here's Bucks County Courier-Times executive editor Patricia Walker.
If it offends some, it's offensive, so why wouldn't we just support their stand and take the stand ourselves to not use the word Redskins in the papers? And that sort of then obviously spreads to include the Washington NFL team. And we said, well, if we're going to do it for the high school, you know, we have to make a bolder and broader decision not to do it at all.
If it still seems puzzling that some people make so much of this word, consider the view of Jossie Ross, a Native American writer and lawyer who posted this on Deadspin last fall. Quote, "Whether or not the term Redskin is inherently racist is the wrong question. The more appropriate question is, would it be acceptable to name a professional sports team according to the color of someone else's skin? Would it ever be cool for a sports team to be called the Washington Blackskins? It seems appropriate. D.C. is the chocolate city. But, hell no. San Francisco Yellowskins? Won't work. None of the above," he wrote, "would be cool." For On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
Ain't nothing else about you I'd ever want to change. Honey, I truly love change your name.
Coming up, after having been convicted and acquitted, Amanda Knox is reconvicted for murder. And also, a talk with the man accused of disrespecting Jeopardy.
This is On the Media.
When I saw you dance, kicking your heels up, I knew it was love forevermore. Honey, I'd love to change your name, make yours and mine one and the same. Ain't nothing else about you I ever want to change. Honey, I truly love to change your name.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, rounding out the hour with two stories about problematic personalities in the media glare. One with very high stakes and one, well, a lot lower. Last week, an Italian court found Amanda Knox guilty of the murder of British student Meredith Kircher again. Knox was first found guilty in 2009. 2 years later, an appeals court overturned the guilty verdict, and after 4 years in prison, Knox returned home to Seattle. This newest guilty verdict will go before Italy's Supreme Court for the final judgment, a process that could last another year. Here's Knox talking to ABC's Robin Roberts last week about how she felt when she heard the second guilty verdict.
I'm going through waves of emotion as in response to it. My first reaction was, no, this is wrong, and I'm going to do everything I can to prove that it is.
It's almost 7 years since this story broke, and an industry of books, websites, and made-for-TV movies has emerged to exploit or investigate the case of Amanda Knox. One of the best accounts can be found in The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, written by Nina Burley. The story begins in the ancient Umbrian city of Perugia on the night of November 1st, 2007.
British student Meredith Kircher was murdered in a cottage that she shared with Amanda Knox and two Italian women. Amanda Knox says she came home in the morning from sleeping with her boyfriend. The door was ajar, went in and took a shower, went back to the boyfriend's house, and then said something strange had happened at my house. There were blood drops in the bathroom. The door was ajar, and she and her boyfriend called the police. The police found this poor girl's body. And Amanda Knox and Raffaele Sollecito, her boyfriend, were arrested and charged with murder.
The reporters and the bloggers were pretty much divided into two groups.
The Innocentisti and the Colpevolisti.
The first thought she was innocent, the second guilty. Your account is a telling example of trial by media.
Immediately, the British media was in there, television stations from all over Italy. The police and the prosecutor were pressured to arrest somebody. Hundreds of reporters pack into the room, and the prosecutor gets up and says, "We have arrested Amanda Knox and Raffaele Sollecito. We believe that they were engaged in a kind of a sex game or even a satanic rite." And then they didn't give any other information. Well, what do you do if you're a reporter and you hear that? Especially if you work for the Italian press, where they have a whole section in the newspaper devoted to lurid, sensational crimes. So what they did was they ran out the door and immediately went to look for information about these students. And what did they find? Amanda Knox had nicknamed herself Foxy Knoxy and had posted pictures of herself on her grand European tour before she got to Italy, holding a machine gun at a Nazi museum in Germany. There was a videotape of her drinking at a party in Seattle. And her boyfriend, Raffaele Sollecito, conveniently posted a picture of himself dressed as a mad doctor and holding a meat cleaver aloft.
There was a leaked video of 20-year-old Amanda and her boyfriend kissing outside the murder scene.
What that was as soon as this crime was known, the photographers in Perugia picked it up on a police radio scanner. They showed up there, and there were Amanda Knox and Raffaele Sollecito standing outside the house while crime scene investigators were going in and out of the cottage, and they hugged and kissed. Once they were arrested, every single time this case was reported on, that little clip of video was run over and over and over again so that it looked like they were actually making out. And the press had a field day. I can tell you, I arrived there in 2009 assuming that I was going to be writing a book about a young woman who had basically turned into Charles Manson. I was basing that on things that I had been reading in the press.
So let's talk about how the various media dealt with this.
The differences between the way the media of Italy, the UK, and the United States operate were glaring. The British tabloids presented it right away as an archetypal battle between good and evil femininity. The pure, innocent British girl and the wild and untamed American, they basically took the prosecutor's story and ran with it. And when it seemed strange, when they realized there was absolutely no physical evidence linking these students to the room where this happened, but there was physical evidence linking a third man who they found in Germany, who was on the lam, whose fingerprints are all over the room, whose DNA was in the body, they didn't do journalism 101 on this guy. His name is Rudy Gaudet. And he basically showed up. The Perugia authorities whisked him through what they call a fast-track trial, and he was put into a cell. Reporters couldn't get to him. The Italian press didn't go around the back and ask questions about what was going on with the prosecutor and why he had created this outlandish theory, because the theory was so salacious and so delicious and so perfect for these columns in what they call the Cronaca Nera, devoted to salacious, passionate crimes. So they processed everything differently. And the there are only a few Americans over there.
Well, there were only two initially covering the trial, right? And they were both in the she's guilty camp.
There were two women there. They were freelancers. And one of them wrote a book, which has been optioned into a movie.
The Newsweek reporter Barbie Lazza-Nadeau wrote in one of her stories during the trial, quote, "She looks comfortable in the courtroom, almost as if she is playing a role rather than facing charges of cutting Meredith's throat while Solecito held back her arms and Gaudet sexually assaulted her." I mean, that is such an indicting sentence. Why has the court of public opinion still decided against Amanda?
I think there are three things going on here. One, the good girl versus the bad girl. That's very popular in Italy. We Americans like it too. Sexist archetypes is one thing here. The other is race. And Rudy Gaudet, being an African Italian, I think there's a kind of a sense that now if you say he did it by himself, you're being racist in some sense. There is another element here besides the sexist archetypes and the race issue, and that is national pride. The Italians subscribe to something called la bella figura. It's about appearance. They dress a certain way. They present themselves in public with dignity. And Amanda Knox, hippie chick from Seattle, breaking into a downward dog in the middle of the police station, kissing the boyfriend in public, having apparently had a lot of sex. The Italians and the Brits are looking at this American. She seems disheveled. She says inappropriate things. And she is rather tone deaf. And I mean, that is one of the problems. She doesn't know how to present herself as authentic. It's a testament to the power of the image. She was presented from the very first day as a pretty girl with a monster inside her. That was the prosecutor's theory. And it's very hard for us to turn away from that.
So, is there any lesson we can take away from the trials of Amanda Knox?
It's an extremely simple crime. It was probably a break-in. This gentleman had broken into at least three houses, climbing in windows in what he thought were empty houses and taking things. And that night, the second floor window was broken into. He was in there. Meredith Kircher came home, and there he was in the house. If you take out the satanic theory, you take out the sexist archetype, you take out national pride, you take out race, and you just look at it, it's pretty clear what happened in that house. But I will say that this is not an Italian phenomenon. Prosecutors don't want to admit they made mistakes, but it's journalism's job to ask those questions. And those questions were not asked in Italy.
Nina, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Nina Verley is the author of The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox. The latest Jeopardy! Sensation has amassed $102,800 on a four-game winning streak, but his playing style is making traditionalists shudder. Arthur Chu has rejected the unwritten rule that the guy or gal with the most facts wins and replaced it with the appalling idea that you can outwit your opponent with the wily application of game theory.
A flurry of tweets and postings like, "This is the face of a Jeopardy villain," and "No respect for Jeopardy tradition."
Jeopardy fans are labeling a new champion whose game-winning tactic involves playing mind games on his opponents.
Arthur Chu says he just did what anyone would do who learned they were going on Jeopardy.
Literally, I hung up the phone and I Googled Jeopardy strategy. There's a group of fans who maintain the Jeopardy archive, the J archive, which is all the transcripts of all the past games that have ever been played. There's a blog called The Final Wager, where he takes apart the wagering strategy in Final Jeopardy, every night of Jeopardy, and talks about the game theoretical aspects of it.
Among the things you encountered, I guess, when you were online was the Forrest Bounce, coined by Chuck Forrest in 1985. The Forrest Bounce refers to bouncing around the categories. So let's listen to some tape of that.
Plants and Trees, 2000.
When fully hydrated, this iconic cactus of the Sonoran Desert, Carnegiea gigantea, may weigh more than 6 tons. Arthur.
What is the saguaro?
The saguaro, yes.
Sigh of relief, 2000.
This term refers to all the material enclosed within a cell membrane, except for the nucleus. Arthur?
What is the cytoplasm?
Right.
31 Days of Oscar, 2000.
For each of your turns, you chose a different category, and you would choose the highest value question each time instead of starting from the cheap question the way that people usually do.
If I stay in one category, it gives my opponents the chance to get used to the category and the chance to figure out the pattern and maybe get an answer before me. So the only way to keep an advantage when you've got one in the game is you use that one edge that you have, the power to choose the next question, and you pick something your opponents aren't expecting.
And another advantage to jumping to the bottom of a category, I guess, was revealed to you by the IBM Jeopardy playing computer Watson, that the two bottom rows of the board are most likely to contain the daily doubles, and whoever gets the most daily doubles is most likely to win.
Daily doubles are one of the few other points you have the power to change the outcome of the game. And it's not just the power to get one that you know and double up your score, is the power to deny it from your opponents to make sure they can't double up their score. So if I don't know one, then I'll bet a very small amount, which is what got a lot of attention when I bet $5 on a sports question.
Sports 1,000.
Answer. Daily double. You can see the score. Eric and Carolyn tied for the lead at 3,800. You're trailing them by $400 only.
$5.
$5. Oh, don't feel confident in sports. All right, here is the clue. Eddie Jackman, Herb Brooks, Conn Smythe.
I don't know.
There was an article in Salon that took the measure of how different you were from, say, Ken Jennings, who is the greatest Jeopardy champ ever. Obviously, you're not anywhere close to his 74-game winning streak. What bothers people is you don't win like he did. You're not buzzing more quickly than your opponents. You don't know more answers to the daily doubles. That you've made this a game of timing and strategy rather than cramming your head with possible answers to questions makes them feel like you're disrespecting the game, in your words.
I would just say we are playing for really very high stakes. I can't justify to myself or my wife leaving money like that on the table out of some aesthetic sense to please Jeopardy viewers. The other thing is Jeopardy is interesting because it's not just a test. Merv Griffin, when he first created Jeopardy, there weren't any daily doubles. There was no Final Jeopardy wagering. The game back then was called What's the Question?
Mm-hmm.
And when he was trying to pitch the game to Hollywood producers, they said, this game needs more Jeopardies. And that's why the game is called Jeopardy, because he injected these elements where the outcome of the game suddenly becomes unpredictable. There becomes strategy and decisions.
As you went through some of those angry tweets, leaving aside the purely ad hominem racist ones, what was the greatest source of indignation? Simply that you were, quote, you know, undermining the integrity of the game?
That was part of it. Because people had a sense that this was unsportsmanlike, people attributed other things to me, saying that I was rude because I was so intent on getting to the next question, I would accidentally talk over Alex, or like I was disrespecting my fellow contestants by glaring at them when they were answering. Really what it was I wanted to keep paying attention to what they were saying, because a big part of Jeopardy is getting that rebound. If they get it wrong, you get a chance to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But it is true that the first thing in my mind was gameplay, and my self-presentation was much lower down on the list. Jeopardy is a very artificial environment in which to encounter someone with very different incentives from day-to-day life. It's not like if I met you at a cocktail party or met you socially. So don't judge what someone's like as a person because of how they act on a TV game show competing for life-changing amounts of money.
It's war out there.
Yeah.
So you're back on Jeopardy in a couple of weeks. I hope we get to keep watching you, Arthur. I like some naked ambition up there.
Thank you.
Arthur Chu, 4-time Jeopardy champion, will be back later this month. We spoke to him from WCPN in Cleveland.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Alana Casanova-Burgess. We had more help from Kimmy Regular, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. We just have to take a moment here to recognize the outstanding Mr. Dunn. He's been filling in for Jen while she was on maternity leave, and he did yeoman's work. Andrew, thanks a million.
Yes, indeed. You steered the ship through some mighty difficult weather. Thank you, Andrew. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can follow us on Twitter, and really you should. It's a dynamite source of media news, from the vital to the bizarre, kind of like peeking into OTM's id. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.